For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Verna Avery Brown. Bush gives the go-ahead for stem cell research under certain circumstances, angering some Republicans and pleasing others. Israeli police seize the PLO headquarters in retaliation for yesterday's bombing. And the call goes out for 1961 Freedom Riders, 40 years after that powerful civil rights movement. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Baghdad says an allied airstrike on southern Iraq has killed one person and wounded 11 others. An air defense spokesman told the official state news agency, quote, American and British planes of evil have conducted a cowardly operation. The report didn't say where the casualties took place. Pentagon officials say that about 20 warplanes took part in the attack and were supported by another 30 aircraft. Officials say they hit a military communications center and a surface-to-air missile launching site. The attack followed stepped-up efforts by Iraq to shoot down Allied planes in the U.S.-British no-fly zone. Britain has suspended the joint Protestant-Catholic government in Northern Ireland. Britain's Northern Ireland Secretary John Reid says he's taken the action to give all sides more time to reach an agreement on a way to continue the power-sharing government. Reid also says that his only other option was to call for new elections. Orla Rappel reports from Dublin.
This latest crisis comes as Ulster Unionist leader David Trimble refuses to accept the IRA statement promising to completely and verifiably put its guns beyond use. Mr. Trimble has pointed out that this statement contains no concession on actual decommissioning and gives no indication on when the process will start. Sinn Féin's Martin McGuinness has said that his party would not accept a suspension as it would be illegal. Orla Rappel, Ireland, for Free Speech Radio News.
Officials at the controversial Temelín nuclear power plant in the southern Czech Republic say the number one reactor will go online by the end of the week after being shut down for months of repairs during its startup. Charles Michael Ray is in Prague and has the story.
The announcement that Temelín will resume its initial testing by starting the number one reactor has been met with resistance and skepticism by those opposed to the project. Temelín uses a controversial combination of Soviet design and Western technology that many fear dangerous. Austrian anti-nuclear groups are planning a border blockade in protest of the move, while some Austrian politicians say the Czech Republic should be kept out of entry into the European Union until it closes Temelín. Meanwhile, the plant fails to meet German safety standards, and the Germans have officially asked the Czechs to shut down the project. Jan Baranek, with Friends of the Earth Czech Republic, says he doubts the startup of the first reactor will last long because of a plague of technical difficulties that he predicts will soon shut it down again for further repairs. Temelín officials insist the plant is safe and ready for operation. They say they are planning to put it on the grid at 55% capacity within the week and will have it in full operation by the end of the year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Prague.
Organized labor unions have called President Bush's plan for a temporary workers program a non-starter. Tara Donner is in Washington.
The labor groups support full legalization of the status of these workers, but the Bush administration has advocated only the granting of temporary guest worker status for Mexican immigrants. Donald Kanyaski, the legislative director for the Laborers International Union, expressed the need for immigrant workers from all countries to have legal status.
We are for a broad and inclusive program when it comes to regularizing the status of immigrants.
He also called for the debate to focus not on guest worker status, but on the pursuit of full legal rights for these immigrants. Proponents of the guest worker status classification believe that while Mexican workers should be documented in the U.S., granting full legal status rewards them for their illegal entry into the country. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, this is Tara Donner.
And finally, a ruling by the Supreme Court in Oregon resulted in the suspension of all undercover investigations, halting street-level drug stings and probes into organized crime and child pornography. A federal judge has agreed to consider two motions challenging the ruling. Denise Kowalczyk reports from Portland.
Last year, the Oregon Supreme Court made a controversial decision to prohibit lawyers from participating in any deceitful behavior or encouraging others to lie. As a result, federal prosecutors have halted all major undercover investigations in Oregon, fearing that they might face disciplinary actions by the U.S. Attorney's Office, which oversees those operations. According to the Portland, Oregon branch of the FBI, a hearing is scheduled in the next few weeks. From Portland, Oregon, I'm Denise Kovalchuk.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
His decision was long awaited and laden with political consequences, regardless of which way he went. And today, researchers and patients' rights advocates cautiously welcomed President Bush's announcement to allow limited federal funding for stem cell research. But others bristled at limits imposed on the work, saying it could ultimately ruin any promise for treating diseases. Religious conservatives, angered by the president's decision, say it means we can kill some in order to cure others. At issue is whether life begins with stem cells and whether they should therefore be protected with the full sanctity of the law afforded any human being. Such a belief rules out using stem cells for scientific research, and many religious conservatives wonder if Bush may have retreated from his pro-life position during the campaign. With more on the controversy and the politics surrounding stem cell research, here's Gareth Schweitzer.
I have concluded that we should allow federal funds to be used for research on these existing stem cell lines, where the life and death decision has already been made. Leading scientists tell me research on these 60 lines has great promise that can lead to breakthrough therapies and cures.
President Bush ended months of indecision last night by deciding to allow federal funding only for stem cell lines already removed from human embryos. His announcement, however, did little to end debate on the issue. Although Bush may have escaped this sensitive subject with little political damage, both medical organizations and anti-abortion groups have expressed varying degrees of unhappiness. Father Joseph Howard of the American Life League felt betrayed by the president's decision.
Well, we are very disappointed. I believe the president has betrayed the American people. He's broken the promise he made as governor and president in writing. We counseled the president that if he knowingly utilized stem cells obtained from human embryos that had been killed, he would be complicit in an unethical action.
The president's announcement last night focused largely on moral and ethical considerations, and Bush attempted to portray his decision as being in line with his anti-abortion commitments.
This allows us to explore the promise and potential of stem cell research without crossing a fundamental moral line by providing taxpayer funding that would sanction or encourage further destruction of human embryos that have at least the potential for life.
The president said last night that there are up to 60 existing stem cell lines to be used, although many scientists believe that number is closer to 10. In addition, many scientists also seem to believe that the president's decision is a setback for public research. According to Dr. Larry Goldstein, a biochemist at UC San Diego, federal funding allows the top public sector scientists to be involved and increases disclosure of new information. Otherwise, the for-profit private sector could limit both disclosure and the social benefits of medical breakthroughs. Goldstein portrayed the limitations placed on the research as potentially crippling in a new field that requires constant experimentation.
Suppose, for example, that some scientist tomorrow derived a new cell line that was vastly superior to those 60 in terms of its properties and possibilities for treating disease. Would we just turn our back on that? We'll probably see some scientists leaving the country if they feel unduly frustrated in moving to Britain or other countries to do the work. And I think that would be unfortunate. It will limit things for no particularly good reason.
It is possible that President Bush has created an even more difficult decision for himself. In Congress, a majority exists in favor of embryonic stem cell research. If they legislate in the fall for increased funding, the president could face an extraordinarily difficult veto decision. In Washington, D.C., this is Gareth Schweitzer for Free Speech Radio News.
Retaliation for yesterday's suicide bombing at a crowded downtown pizza restaurant in Jerusalem comes swiftly. Dozens of Israeli police officers have seized the PLO headquarters in East Jerusalem, lowering the Palestinian flag and raising the Israeli flag in its place. Half a dozen Palestinian guards were taken in for questioning and documents were removed. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Raphael Kraft was at the Orient House when the takeover was executed. he files his report.
There were no more than 100 Western and Israeli peace activists as well as Palestinians that came to demonstrate in front of the alley leading to the Orient House, which was blocked by the Israeli police. The demonstrators were chanting, "Jerusalem is Arabic." The symbol of the Palestinian political and cultural presence in the occupied East Jerusalem was raided by more than 100 Israeli soldiers last night. They arrested 7 Palestinians that were in the house during the attack and confiscated a number of documents. This morning, the Israeli flag was flying on top of the Palestinian building. Michel Warshavsky, a prominent Israeli peace activist, was among the demonstrators in the vicinity of the Orient House.
This is part of the offensive policy of the Israeli government, a policy that began with the Camp David failure with Ehud Barak and that's driving us right into a wall. Because I don't think one needs to be too intelligent or a brilliant politician to understand that such measures will provoke more suicide bomb attacks, that the Palestinians feel that their back is against the wall. They will organize retaliations where they can and without warning.
The Israeli government spokesman, Ranan Gissin, justified the occupation of Orient House this morning, stating that the Orient House was connected to the suicide bomb attack yesterday in Jerusalem.
One shouldn't believe a word anymore from the spokesman of this government. Actually, Sharon himself said, "We are not obliged to tell the truth and we'll tell lies." He said that, so I can't be accused of defaming him. And although I don't have specific information to deny the government's charges, the Orient House has nothing to do with this bomb attack. It's clear that Islamic Jihad perpetrated the blast. They had announced it. The bomb attack was programmed. They had announced that the assassination of their chiefs would be followed by 2 bomb blasts, one in Jerusalem and the other in Tel Aviv. And unfortunately, I can assure you that the second bomb attack should be expected in Tel Aviv. They have an account to settle. They have retaliations to carry out. Civilians will once again pay the price, but our government holds full responsibility in this.
There are very few Palestinians in the demonstration today. Is there a reason why?
Because they're afraid. I know the Jerusalem police very well. I know the tense situations that have occurred here, and I have rarely seen such a deployment of forces. As you can see there, the whole block around the Orient House has been completely sealed off. So the Palestinians are terrorized by the heavy presence of Israeli forces, which is rarely seen when so much media is on the spot. This is the reason why few Palestinians came here today. There are very few Israelis, and there is a number of very courageous internationals that have to be appreciated for putting their bodies between the Israeli police and the dozens of Palestinians that remain in the demonstration.
After several charges by Israeli police horseback, most of the Palestinian demonstrators withdrew before finally quitting the demonstration. A group of a dozen of peace activists headed by the International Solidarity Movement tried in vain to continue their nonviolent sit-in. Yasmin Khayal, a German-Palestinian peace activist, was among them. She describes the behavior of the soldiers standing in front of her.
Look at this kid, for example. He's not older than me. They give him this big weapon. He doesn't even want to tell me how old he is because he knows that he's probably even younger than me, or because somebody, the Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, a war criminal responsible for the massacres of Sabra and Shatila, gave him the orders not to talk to the people they're confronted with, right? So they just give them big guns, and then they feel really, really strong, and then they... It shows the kind of force they're using against unarmed demonstrators.
Unarmed civilian demonstrators. They bring M16s,
peaceful
batons.
Demonstrators. We're just peaceful demonstrators.
It shows that they have all to fear and we have everything to gain.
The violence of the police was carefully measured in front of the international media. But at the end of the nonviolent demonstration, the Israeli lawyer of the International Solidarity Movement was singled out by the Israeli police and taken away from the cameras, where she was beaten up before being arrested.
I'm a lawyer trying to stop this demonstration! Look what they do! Look what they do! I'm a lawyer! I came here to observe!
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in East Jerusalem.
כל המדרכה מהצד השני, כל המדרכה מהצד השני, כל הצלמים בבקשה.
A new report out by the human rights group Amnesty International says authorities in India are failing to prevent violence against women and sometimes take an active part in it. Released as part of the organization's campaign to stop torture, the battle against fear and discrimination highlights patterns of violence, including the beating, stripping, and rape of Indian women. It focuses particularly on Dalits or untouchables and tribal women and their lack of access to justice and the failure of the state to protect them at the local level. The report found that these women often suffer a double discrimination, discrimination on the basis of caste as well as gender. But as Sputnik Colombi reports from Hyderabad, there are some signs of hope. She looks at a nonprofit in Hyderabad that's helping to empower women.
Every city has a fringe, home to a substantial number of people who remain always on the margins of society. These fringes are growing inexorably in India today, vulnerable to unscrupulous elements and an easy prey to vested interests, where chronic underdevelopment combines explosively with negative stereotyping, a hotbed of communal violence. Hyderabad knows it as the old city. Inhabited mainly by Muslims, 75% of the population, as well as other marginalized sections like the Dalits, formerly known as the Untouchables. The Charminar, built 5 centuries ago to immortalize the love of a Muslim prince and a Hindu girl. Its 4 minarets look onto a maze of crowded little streets. This is the heart of the old city, and the offices of COVA, Confederation of Voluntary Associations, are just next to the bus terminal. COVA brings together over 200 groups operating in various slums in the old city. They promote communal harmony through economic development. A major part of COVA's work is carried out through the various women's self-help groups spread across the slums. The emphasis is on economic empowerment, literacy and social dignity. COVA's Mazhar Hussain.
These women earlier had nothing officially in their names, whether it was their ration card for the house which was in the husband's name or the house which was in the husband's name. Even unfortunately in India, the children are also registered under the husband's name, father's name, not the mother's name. When these groups were started and we gave them these passbooks, savings passbooks, that was the first thing which they had in which their name was written. So that really gave them a very different sense of identity. And secondly, it also gave them some access to money, you know, some capital, which earlier it was not possible for them. They would have very small amounts with them, only for household expenses. All the money would be retained and spent by the husbands. Now here there was some money which they could call their own.
Over 200 groups have now been formed as mutually aided cooperatives. Members are allowed to take loans from a common fund worth 3 to 5 times the amount they put in. Interest rates are minimal and the group itself acts as guarantor. Initially, loans were taken more for consumption purposes, but now increasingly they're being taken up to set up micro-enterprises. The Mahila Sanatkar is one such initiative. Slum women, Muslim and Hindu, are given training in skills such as sewing, the traditional Hyderabad karchol technique of working on fabric and jute products. Economic empowerment and social awareness go hand in hand, says Asya Khatun.
There were so many illiterate women who came to us. Most of them felt very strongly that they would have been better off if they had been given the chance to get educated. We also gave them medical advice and legal counseling, so that if we were in communal riots in the future, they would know what to do, what their rights are, and how they can care for the children. Along with this, naturally, there was a program for economic development.
But getting the self-help project off the ground and convincing women they could take control of their lives was an uphill task, says Mazhar Hussain.
See, the first and foremost difficulty was getting the women out and get them involved. Second difficulty was with the husbands and men in the thing. Now, most of them were very reluctant, and quite a few of them actively stopped their wives from coming to these meetings. In some cases, they were even beaten up. But still, the women persisted and came to these meetings. And today, you will be happy to know that a number of men are approaching us with the request that we should form men's groups. And we have already started about 10 men's groups.
If women are by and large the second sex in India, the lot of Muslim women is even worse. Changing the mindset of the men was a major challenge, says social worker Geeta Devi. But after 5 years, there has been a sea change.
Earlier, the men would have behaved as they wished. They would beat up their wives, drink, and things like that. In one slum, a mother-in-law and her son got together and poured kerosene oil on the daughter-in-law. But some volunteers got there on time and told them that a case would be booked against them and that they would end up in jail. The family immediately poured water on the girl and begged for forgiveness. They fell at the feet of the volunteers and said they had made a mistake and pleaded with them not to book a case.
COVA's awareness programs emphasizing legal rights, child care, and health issues are having an impact. A striking indicator is the change in the attitude towards the girl child, says Mazhar Hussain.
You go into any area now and you ask them about when they would like to get their girls married. You will find all of them, and even the girls, saying that after 18. Earlier, it used to be just about 12, 13, 14, you know, the girls would be married. Secondly, now they are sending, more and more of them are sending their children to school. And also the girls are also, you know, being allowed to go to school, which earlier was not there.
I am Ali. 19-year-old Safiya has been with the Mahila Sanatkar for a year now. Before that, she sat at home. She never went to school. Today, her skill with jute nets her around ₹300 a month. Safiya's dark eyes gleam with determination and pride when she says she will continue working after marriage, which is due to take place in a year.
Izzat mili naam shohrat itna kuch hua sab khush hai kyunki har ek koi izzat de rahe hai ki itna bada kaam kar rahe hai acha kaam kar rahe hai.
I got respect here. My work is being recognized. Everybody tells me my work is good and they respect me. What more does one want if one has respect? Who respects people who stay at home? Now they tell me, you're going to an office, you're meeting big people, you're getting training.
Under Asiya Khatun's dynamic leadership, the Mahila Sanatkar has embarked upon an ambitious marketing strategy. Today, their products, cushion covers, embroidery and jute work, to name just a few, are being sold at the prestigious Delhi Hut in the Indian capital.
In 1998,
some 14, 15 of us, all office bearers, went on an exposure tour to Delhi, Ahmedabad and Calcutta. We were taken care of by women's groups in those cities. We would visit around during the day and hold discussions every night. One idea was on everybody's minds, that we should create a cooperative and make a product that did not exist in the market. Thanks to this exposure trip, Hindus, Muslims, and Sikhs were all together. There was a tremendous interaction between women of different communities. Not much. There was a distance. This was the first time in their lives that these women had left home, leaving their husbands and children. But they had made arrangements for the cooking to be done and came with me. And they enjoyed themselves in such a normal way that I felt really happy.
Conflict between communities need not be inevitable. Communal harmony can, if the will is there. And it certainly seems to be there today in the old city of Hyderabad. This is Sputnik Kilambi for Free Speech Radio News, Hyderabad.
More hearings are set today for accused church bomber Bobby Frank Cherry, and a standing room crowd only is expected in Judge Garrett's Birmingham courtroom. Cherry is accused in the 1963 church bombing that killed four African-American girls as they attended Sunday school. Prosecutors have asked that Cherry be held in a state mental hospital until he can be determined mentally competent to stand trial. Local activists have staged a continuing protest and warned that demonstrators will stage acts of civil disobedience unless their demands are met. That determined spirit to see justice done, even 38 years after the crime was committed, is reminiscent of the spirit embodied in a movement known as the Freedom Riders. Some 400 black, white, and Jewish students boarded buses across the country and rode down to Jackson, Mississippi to take a stand against segregation. Carol Ruth Silver is chair of the Freedom Riders Reunion Committee. She took us back to that day in 1961 when she and her classmates helped to change the course of history.
The Freedom Rides happened because nobody was paying attention. Nobody in the power community, in the white community, was looking at the travails and the terrible discrimination which was being visited on blacks in the South and to a substantial extent in the North as well. And we were so imbued with our religious and idealistic convictions that we said we are willing to put our lives on the line, we're willing to put our careers on the line, we are willing to stand up because this is wrong.
Did you feel back in the 60s, in 1961, that you were actually putting your life on the line? Was there any danger to you and the others that boarded the buses and conducted the Freedom Ride?
Oh, yes. The Freedom Rides, the big Freedom Rides in which I participated, there were about 300 or 400 people who were arrested in Jackson at that time. But the call for those Freedom Riders to come south came out of the burning bus that was the start of everything. A burning bus which could have been an absolutely incredible disaster. In Anniston, Alabama, the first Freedom Riders were stopped. Their bus was trashed, the tires were slashed, and the bus was allowed to leave, but then stopped, became disabled at the side of the road in a country area. And Ku Klux Klansmen came along, firebombed this bus, which contained a group of people of 13 Freedom Riders, and had the gas tanks in the bus not exploded, allowing them to get out, the Ku Klux Klansmen had barred the doors so that they would have incinerated in this bus. I mean, that's not very nice. And those people who were willing to do that, who were willing essentially to kill the peaceful, absolutely nonviolent Freedom Riders, were still loose in Mississippi, are still loose in Mississippi and Alabama at the present time in many fewer numbers. But at the time that we were going down, we were all prepared for that. That is what we were going into, and we all, you know, said goodbye to our loved ones. We said this is as important as anything we would ever do with our lives, and we are prepared. We are prepared to take every precaution so that if possible, we will not be killed. But if we have to stand for our principles, we will stand.
How many of the 400 men and women have you all been able to gather up?
We have a list. Finally, it took a great deal of research in the basement of the Jackson City Jail to get the list of the people who were arrested in Jackson in 1961. And we've identified a little, a few more than 400 that are on that list. But all we have for many of them is a name and a location from whence they came when they were coming to Jackson 40 years ago. So far, we know where about 120 of those people either are or that they have passed away or, you know, we have identified them. But we're still looking for the other 300, and we hope that anyone who knows anybody that has ever mentioned to them over the last 40 years that they were a Freedom Rider will give us a call at our headquarters here in San Francisco and will give us the name of that person, give us whatever information they have about it. If I may, our 1-800 number is 1-888-242-5415. And if you call that number, it's a free call, and give your information, it would be just wonderful. 1-888-242-5415.
Carol Ruth Silver. The Freedom Riders are gathering again, but this time for a celebration and a 40th year reunion. Anybody associated with that class of civil rights pioneers can visit their website at www.freedomridersfoundation.com. The reunion is November 8th through the 11th.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. I'm Verna Avery Brown.